Chapter 10. It had been a terrible 2 weeks for Mr. Baines. From his hotel room, he had called the trade mission every day at noon to ask if the old gentleman had put in an appearance. The answer had been an unvarying no. Mr. Tacomi's voice had become colder and more formal each day. As Mr. Baines prepared to make his 16th call, he thought, "Sooner or later they'll tell me that Mr. Tacomi is out, that he isn't accepting any more calls from me. And that will be that." What has happened? Where is Mr. Yatabi? He had a fairly good idea. The death of Martin Borman had caused immediate consternation in Tokyo. Mr. Yatabi no doubt had been en route to San Francisco, a day or so offshore, when new instructions had reached him. Return to the home islands for further consultation. Bad luck, Mr. Baines realized. Possibly even fatal. But he had to remain where he was, in San Francisco, still trying to arrange the meeting for which he had come. 45 minutes by Lufthansa rocket from Berlin, and now this. A weird time in which we are alive. We can travel anywhere we want, even to other planets. And for what? To sit day after day, declining in morale and hope, falling into an interminable ennui. And meanwhile, the others are busy. They are not sitting helplessly waiting. Mr. Baines unfolded the midday edition of the Nippon Times and once more read the headlines. Dr. Goebbels named Reichs-Chancellor. Surprise solution to leadership problem by Partei Committee. Radio speech viewed decisive. Berlin crowds cheer. Statement expected. Göring may be named police chief over Heydrich. He reread the entire article, and then he put the paper once more away, took the phone, and gave the trade mission number. "This is Mr. Baines. May I have Mr. Tagomi?"
"A moment, sir."
A very long moment.
"Mr. Tagomi here."
Mr. Baines took a deep breath and said,
"Forgive this situation, depressing to us both, sir."
"Ah, Mr. Baines."
"Your hospitality to me, sir, could not be exceeded. Some day I know you will have understanding of the reasons which cause me to defer our conference until the old gentleman, regretfully, he has not arrived."
Mr. Baines shut his eyes.
"I thought maybe since yesterday."
"Afraid not, sir."
The barest politeness.
"If you will excuse me, Mr. Baines. Pressing business."
"Good day, sir."
The phone clicked. Today Mr. Tagomi had rung off without even saying goodbye. Mr. Baines slowly hung the receiver.
"I must take action. Can wait no longer."
It had been made very clear to him by his superiors that he was not to contact the Abwehr under any circumstances. He was simply to wait until he had managed to make connections with the Japanese military representative. He was to confer with the Japanese, and then he was to return to Berlin. But no one had foreseen that Borman would die at this particular moment. Therefore, the orders had to be superseded by more practical advice, his own in this case, since there was no one else to consult. In the PSA, at least 10 Abwehr persons were at work, but some of them, and possibly all, were known to the local SD and its competent senior regional chief, Bruno Kreutz von Meer. Years ago, he had met Bruno briefly at a Partei gathering. The man had had a certain infamous prestige in police circles, inasmuch as it had been he, in 1943, who had uncovered the British-Czech plot on Reinhard Heydrich's life, and therefore who might be said to have saved the hangman from assassination. In any case, Bruno Kreutz von Meer was already then ascending in authority, within the SD. He was not a mere police bureaucrat. He was, in fact, a rather dangerous man. There was even a possibility that even with all the precautions taken, both on the part of the Abwehr in Berlin and the Tokuka in Tokyo, the SD had learned of this attempted meeting in San Francisco in the offices of the ranking trade mission. However, this was, after all, Japanese-administered land. The SD had no official authority to interfere. It could see to it that the German principal, himself in this case, was arrested as soon as he set foot again on Reich territory, but it could hardly take action against the Japanese principal or against the existence of the meeting itself. At least, so he hoped. Was there any possibility that the SD had managed to detain the old Japanese gentleman somewhere along the route? It was a long way from Tokyo to San Francisco, especially for a person so elderly and frail that he could not attempt air travel. "What I must do," Mr. Baines knew, "is find out from those above me whether Mr. Yatabi is still coming." They would know. If the SD had intercepted him, or if the Tokyo government had recalled him, they would know that.
And if they have managed to get to the old gentleman, he realized, they certainly are going to get to me. Yet the situation, even in those circumstances, was not hopeless. An idea had come to Mr. Baines as he waited day after day alone in his room at the Aberati Hotel. It would be better to give my information to Mr. Tagomi than to return to Berlin empty-handed. At least that way there would be a chance, even if it is rather slight, that ultimately the proper people will be informed. But Mr. Tagomi could only listen. That was the fault in his idea. At best, he could hear, commit to memory, and as soon as possible take a business trip back to the home islands. Whereas Mr. Yatabi stood at policy level. He could both hear and speak. Still, it was better than nothing. The time was growing too short. To begin all over, to arrange painstakingly, cautiously, over a period of months, once again, the delicate contact between a faction in Germany and a faction in Japan. It certainly would surprise Mr. Tagomi, he thought acidly, to suddenly find knowledge of that kind resting on his shoulders, a long way from facts about injection molds. Possibly he might have a nervous breakdown, either blurt out the information to someone around him, or withdraw, pretend even to himself that he had not heard it, simply refuse to believe me, rise to his feet, bow and excuse himself from the room the moment I begin. Indiscreet, he could regard it that way. He is not supposed to hear such matters. So easy, Mr. Baines thought. The way out is so immediate, so available to him. He thought, I wish it was for me. And yet, in the final analysis, it is not possible even for Mr. Tagomi. We are no different. He can close his ears to the news as it comes from me, comes in the form of words. But later, when it is not a matter of words, if I can make that clear to him now, or to whomever I finally speak. Leaving his hotel room, Mr. Baines descended by elevator to the lobby. Outside on the sidewalk, he had the doorman call a pedicab for him, and soon he was on his way up Market Street, the Chinese driver pumping away energetically. There, he said to the driver, when he made out the sign which he was watching for. Pull over to the curb. The pedicab stopped by a fire hydrant. Mr. Baines paid the driver and sent him off. No one seemed to have followed. Mr. Baines set off along the sidewalk on foot. A moment later, along with several other shoppers, he entered the big downtown Fuga department store. There were shoppers everywhere, counter after counter, salesgirls, mostly white, with a sprinkling of Japanese as department managers. The din was terrific. After some confusion, Mr. Baines located the men's clothing department. He stopped at the racks of men's trousers and began to inspect them. Presently a clerk, a young white, came over, greeting him. Mr. Baines said, I have returned for the pair of dark brown wool slacks which I was looking at yesterday. Meeting the clerk's gaze, he said, You are not the man I spoke to. He was taller, red mustache, rather thin. On his jacket he had the name Larry. The clerk said, He is presently out to lunch, but will return. I'll go into a dressing room and try these on. Mr. Baines said, taking a pair of slacks from the rack. Certainly, sir. The clerk indicated a vacant dressing room and then went off to wait on someone else. Mr. Baines entered the dressing room and shut the door. He seated himself on one of the two chairs and waited. After a few minutes, there was a knock. The door of the dressing room opened, and a short, middle-aged Japanese entered. You are from out of state, sir, he said to Mr. Baines. And I am to okay your credit? Let me see your identification. He shut the door behind him. Mr. Baines got out his wallet. The Japanese seated himself with the wallet and began inspecting the contents. He halted at a photo of a girl. Very pretty. My daughter, Martha. I, too, have a daughter named Martha, the Japanese said. She at present is in Chicago studying piano. My daughter, Mr. Baines said, is about to be married. The Japanese returned the wallet and waited expectantly. Mr. Baines said, I have been here 2 weeks and Mr. Yatabi has not shown up. I want to find out if he is still coming, and if not, what I should do. Return tomorrow afternoon, the Japanese said. He rose and Mr. Baines also rose. Good day. Good day, Mr. Baines said. He left the dressing room, hung the pair of slacks back up on the rack, and left the Fuga department store. That did not take very long, he thought, as he moved along the busy downtown sidewalk with the other pedestrians. Can he actually get the information by then? Contact Berlin, relay my questions, do all the coding and decoding, every step involved? Apparently so. Now I wish I had approached the agent sooner. I would have saved myself such worry and distress. And evidently no major risk was involved. It had all appeared to go off smoothly. It took, in fact, only 5 or 6 minutes. Mr. Baines wandered on, looking into store windows. He felt much better now. Presently he found himself viewing display photos of honky-tonk cabarets, grimy, fly-specked, utterly white nudes, whose breasts hung like half-inflated volleyballs. That sight amused him, and he loitered, people pushing past him on their various errands up and down Market Street. At least he had done something, at last. What a relief! Propped comfortably against the car door, Juliana read. Beside her, his elbow out the window, Joe drove with one hand lightly on the wheel, a cigarette stuck to his lower lip. He was a good driver, and they had covered a good deal of the distance from Cannon City already. The car radio played mushy beer garden folk music, an accordion band doing one of the countless polkas or schottisches. She had never been able to tell them one from another. "Kitsch," Joe said when the music ended. "Listen, I know a lot about music. I'll tell you who a great conductor was. You probably don't remember him. Arturo Toscanini."
"No," she said, still reading.
"He was Italian, but the Nazis wouldn't let him conduct after the war because of his politics. He's dead now. I don't like that Von Karajan, permanent conductor of the New York Philharmonic. We had to go to concerts by him, our work dorm. What I like, being a WOP, you can guess." He glanced at her.
"You like that book?" he said. "It's engrossing."
"I like Verdi and Puccini. All we get in New York is a heavy German bombastic Wagner and Orff, and we have to go every week to one of those corny U.S. Nazi Party dramatic spectacles at the Madison Square Garden, with the flags and the drums and trumpets and the flickering flame. History of the Gothic tribes, or other educational crap, chanted instead of spoken, so as to be called art. Did you ever see New York before the war?"
"Yes," she said, trying to read.
"Didn't they have swell theater in those days? That's what I heard. Now it's the same as the movie industry. It's all a cartel in Berlin. In the 13 years I've been in New York, not one good musical or play ever opened. Only those..."
"Let me read,"
Juliana said.
"And the same with the book business," Joe said, unperturbed. "It's all a cartel operating out of Munich. All they do in New York is print, just big printing presses. But before the war, New York was the center of the world's publishing industry, or so they say."
Putting her fingers in her ears, she concentrated on the page open in her lap, shutting his voice out. She had arrived at a section in The Grasshopper which described the fabulous television, and it enthralled her, especially the part about the inexpensive little sets for backward people in Africa and Asia. "Only Yankee know-how and the mass production system, Detroit, Chicago, Cleveland, the magic names, could have done the trick, sent that ceaseless and almost witlessly noble flood of cheap $1, the China dollar, the trade dollar, television kits to every village and backwater of the Orient. And when the kit had been assembled by some gaunt, feverish-minded youth in the village, starved for a chance, for that which the generous Americans held out to him, that tinny little instrument with its built-in power supply, no larger than a marble, began to receive. And what did it receive? Crouching before the screen, the youths of the village, and often the elders as well, saw words, instructions, how to read first, then the rest, how to dig a deeper well, plow a deeper furrow, how to purify their water, heal their sick. Overhead, the American artificial moon wheeled, distributing the signal, carrying it everywhere, to all the waiting, avid masses of the East.
"Are you reading straight through?" Joe asked. "Or skipping around in it?"
She said, "This is wonderful. He has us sending food and education to all the Asiatics, millions of them."
"Welfare work on a worldwide scale," Joe said.
"Yes, the New Deal under Tugwell. They raise the level of the masses. Listen,"
she read aloud to Joe.
What had China been? Yearning, one needful commingled entity looking toward the West, its great democratic president, Chiang Kai-shek,
who had led the Chinese people through the years of war, now into the years of peace, on to the decade of rebuilding. But for China, it was not rebuilding, for that almost supernaturally vast flat land had never been built, lay still slumbering in the ancient dream. Arousing, yes, the entity, the giant, had to partake at last of full consciousness, had to waken into the modern world with its jet airplanes and atomic power, its autobahns and factories and medicines. And from whence would come the crack of thunder which would rouse the giant? Chang had known that, even during the struggle to defeat Japan. It would come from the United States. And by 1950, American technicians and engineers, teachers, doctors, agronomists, swarming like some new life form into each province, each... Interrupting, Joe said,
"You know what he's done, don't you? He's taken the best about Nazism, the socialist part, the Tat organization, and the economic advances we got through Speer. And who's he giving the credit to? The New Deal. And he's left out the bad part, the SS part, the racial extermination and segregation. It's a utopia. You imagine if the Allies had won, the New Deal would have been able to revive the economy and make those socialist welfare improvements like he says? Hell no. He's talking about the form of state syndicalism, the corporate estate, like we developed under the Duce. He's saying, you would have had all the good and none of...
Let me read, she said fiercely. He shrugged, but he did cease babbling. She read on at once, but to herself. And these markets, the countless millions of China, set the factories in Detroit and Chicago to humming. That vast mouth could never be filled. Those people could not in 100 years be given enough trucks or bricks or steel ingots or clothing or typewriters or canned peas or clocks or radios or nose drops. The American workman, by 1960, had the highest standard of living in the world, and all due to what they genteelly called the Most Favored Nation clause in every commercial transaction with the East. The U.S. no longer occupied Japan, and she had never occupied China. And yet the fact could not be disputed. Canton and Tokyo and Shanghai did not buy from the British. They bought American. And with each sale, the working man in Baltimore or Los Angeles or Atlanta saw a little more prosperity. It seemed to the planners, the men of vision in the White House, that they had almost achieved their goal. The exploring rocket ships would soon nose cautiously out into the void, from a world that had at last seen an end to its age-old griefs, hunger, plague, war, ignorance. In the British Empire, equal measures towards social and economic progress had brought similar relief to the masses in India, Burma, Africa, the Middle East. The factories of the Ruhr, Manchester, of the Saar, the oil of Baku, all flowed and interacted to intricate but effective harmony. The populations of Europe basked in what appeared...
I think they should be the rulers, Juliana said, pausing. They always were the best, the British.
Joe said nothing to that, although she waited. At last she went on reading. Realization of Napoleon's vision, rational homogeneity of the diverse ethnic strains which had squabbled and balkanized Europe since the collapse of Rome. Vision two of Charlemagne, united Christendom, totally at peace, not only with itself, but with the balance of the world. And yet, there still remained one annoying sore. Singapore. The Malay states held a large Chinese population, mostly of the enterprising business class, and these thrifty, industrious bourgeois saw in American administration of China a more equitable treatment of what was called the native. Under British rule, the darker races were excluded from the country clubs, the hotels, the better restaurants. They found themselves, as in archaic times, confined to particular sections of the train and bus and, perhaps worst of all, limited to their choice of residence within each city. These natives discerned, and noted in their table conversations and newspapers, that in the USA the color problem had by 1950 been solved. Whites and Negroes lived and worked and ate shoulder by shoulder, even in the Deep South. World War II had ended discrimination.
Is there trouble?
Juliana asked Joe. He grunted, keeping his eyes on the road.
"Tell me what happens," she said. "I know I won't get to finish it. We'll be in Denver pretty soon. Do America and Britain get into a war, and one emerges as ruler of the world?"
Presently Joe said, "In some ways it's not a bad book. He works all the details out. The U.S. has the Pacific, about like our East Asia co-prosperity sphere. They divide Russia. It works for around 10 years. Then there's trouble, naturally." Why naturally?
Human nature, Joe added. Nature of states, suspicion, fear, greed. Churchill thinks the USA is undermining British rule in South Asia by appealing to the large Chinese populations, who naturally are pro-USA due to Chiang Kai-shek. The British start setting up, he grinned at her briefly, what are called detention preserves, concentration camps, in other words, for thousands of maybe disloyal Chinese. They're accused of sabotage and propaganda. Churchill is so...
You mean he's still in power? Wouldn't he be around 90?
Joe said, that's where the British system has it over the American. Every 8 years, the U.S. boots out its leaders, no matter how qualified. But Churchill just stays on. The U.S. doesn't have any leadership like him, after Tugwell. Just non-entities. And the older he gets, the more autocratic and rigid he gets. Churchill, I mean. Until, by 1960, he's like some old warlord out of Central Asia. Nobody can cross him. He's been in power 20 years.
Good God, she said, leafing through the last part of the book, searching for verification of what Joe was saying.
On that I agree, Joe said. Churchill was the one good leader the British had during the war. If they'd retained him, they'd have been better off. I tell you, a state is no better than its leader. Führerprinzip, principle of leadership, like the Nazis say. They're right. Even this Abinson has to face that. Sure, the USA expands economically after winning the war over Japan, because it's got that huge market in Asia that it's wrested from the Japs. But that's not enough. That's got no spirituality. Not that the British have. They're both plutocracies, ruled by the rich. If they had won, all they'd have thought about was making more money, the upper class. Abinson, he's wrong. There would be no social reform, no welfare public works plans. The Anglo-Saxon plutocrats wouldn't have permitted it. Juliana thought, spoken like a devout fascist. Evidently, Joe perceived by her expression what she was thinking. He turned toward her, slowing the car, one eye on her, one on the cars ahead. Listen, I'm not an intellectual. Fascism has no need of that. What is wanted is the deed. Theory derives from action. What our corporate state demands from us is comprehension of the social forces, of history. You see? I tell you, I know, Juliana.
His tone was earnest, almost beseeching.
Those old rotten money-run empires, Britain and France and USA, although the latter actually a sort of bastard sideshoot, not strictly empire, but money-oriented even so, they had no soul, so naturally no future, no growth. Nazis, a bunch of street thugs. I agree. You agree, right?
She had to smile. His Italian mannerisms had overpowered him in his attempt to drive and make his speech simultaneously.
Abinson talks like it's a big issue as to whether U.S. or Britain ultimately wins out. Bull! Has no merit, no history to it. Six of one, a dozen of other. You ever read what the Duce wrote? Inspired. Beautiful man. Beautiful writing. Explains the underlying actuality of every event. Real issue in war was old versus new. Money. That's why Nazis dragged Jewish question mistakenly into it. Versus communal mass spirit. What Nazis called Gemeinschaft, folkness, like Soviet. Commune, right? Only communists sneaked in Pan-Slavic Peter the Great Empire ambitions along with it, made social reform means for imperial ambitions.
Juliana thought, like Mussolini did. Exactly.
Nazi thuggery, a tragedy,
Joe stuttered away as he passed a slow-moving truck.
But change is always harsh on the loser. Nothing new. Look at previous revolutions such as French or Cromwell against Irish. Too much philosophy and Germanic temperament. Too much theater, too. All those rallies. You never find true fascists talking, only doing. Like me, right?
Laughing, she said, God, you've been talking a mile a minute. He shouted excitedly.
I'm explaining fascist theory of action.
She couldn't answer. It was too funny. But the man beside her did not think it was funny. He glowered at her, his face red. Veins in his forehead became distended, and he began once more to shake. And again he passed his fingers clutchingly along his scalp, forward and back, not speaking, only staring at her.
Don't get sore at me, she said.
For a moment she thought he was going to hit her. He drew his arm back. But then he grunted, reached and turned up the car radio. They drove on, band music from the radio, static. Once more she tried to concentrate on the book.
"You're right," Joe said after a long time.
"About what?"
"Two-bit empire. Clown for a leader. No wonder we got the nothing out of the war."
She patted his arm.
"Juliana, it's all darkness," Joe said. "Nothing is true or certain, right?"
"Maybe so,"
she said absently, continuing to try to read.
"Britain wins," Joe said, indicating the book. "I save you the trouble. U.S. dwindles. Britain keeps needling and poking and expanding, keeps the initiative. So put it away."
"I hope we have fun in Denver," she said, closing the book. "You need to relax. I want you to."
"If you don't," she thought, "you're going to fly apart in a million pieces, like a bursting spring. And what happens to me then? How do I get back? And do I just leave you?" "I want the good time you promised me," she thought. "I don't want to be cheated. I've been cheated too much in my life before, by too many people."
"We'll have it," Joe said. "Listen."
He studied her with a queer, introspective expression.
"You take it to that grasshopper book so much. I wonder, do you suppose a man who writes a bestseller, an author like that, Abinson, do people write letters to him? I bet lots of people praise his book by letters to him, maybe even visit."
All at once she understood.
"Joe, it's only another 100 miles.
His eyes shone. He smiled at her, happy again, no longer flushed or troubled.
"We could," she said. "You drive so good, it'd be nothing to go on up there, would it?"
Slowly, Joe said,
"Well, I doubt a famous man lets visitors drop in. Probably, so many of them."
"Why not try? Joe!"
She grabbed his shoulder, squeezed him excitedly.
"All he could do is send us away. Please?"
With great deliberation, Joe said,
"When we've gone shopping and got new clothes, all spruced up, that's important, to make a good impression, and maybe even rent a new car up in Cheyenne. But you can do that."
"Yes," she said. "And you need a haircut. And let me pick your clothes, please, Joe. I used to pick Frank's clothes for him. A man can never buy his own clothes."
"You got the good taste in clothes," Joe said, once more turning toward the road ahead, gazing out somberly. "In other ways, too. Better if you call him, contact him."
"I'll get my hair done," she said.
"Good."
"I'm not scared at all to walk up and ring the bell," Juliana said. "I mean, you live only once. Why should we be intimidated? He's just a man like the rest of us. In fact, he probably would be pleased to know somebody drove so far just to tell him how much they liked his book. We can get an autograph on the book, on the inside, where they do that. Isn't that so? We better buy a new copy. This one is all stained. It wouldn't look good."
"Anything you want," Joe said. "I'll let you decide all the details. I know you can do it. Pretty girl always gets everyone. When he sees what a knockout you are, he'll open the door wide. But listen, no monkey business."
"What do you mean?"
"You say we're married. I don't want you getting mixed up with him, you know. That would be dreadful. Wreck everyone's existence. Some reward for him to let visitors in. Some irony. So watch it, Juliana."
"You can argue with him," Juliana said. "That part about Italy losing the war by betraying them? Tell him what you told me."
Joe nodded. "That's so. We can discuss the whole subject." They drove swiftly on. At 7 o'clock the following morning, PSA reckoning, Mr. Nobusuke Togomi rose from bed, started toward the bathroom, then changed his mind and went directly to the Oracle. Seated cross-legged on the floor of his living room, he began manipulating the 49 yarrow stalks. He had a deep sense of the urgency of his questioning, and he worked at a feverish pace until at last he had the 6 lines before him. Shock. Hexagram 51. God appears in the sign of the arousing. Thunder and lightning. Sounds. He involuntarily put his fingers up to cover his ears. Ha-ha! Ho-ho!
great burst that made him wince and blink. Lizard scurries and tiger roars, and out comes God himself.
What does it mean? He peered about his living room. Arrival of what?
He hopped to his feet and stood panting, waiting.
Nothing. Heart pounding. Respiration and all somatic processes, including all manner of diencephalic-controlled autonomic responses to crisis. Adrenaline, greater heartbeat, pulse rate, glands pouring, throat paralyzed, eyes staring, bowels loose et al., stomach queasy and sex instinct suppressed. And yet, nothing to see. Nothing for body to do. Run? All in preparation for panic flight. But where to and why? Mr. Tagomi asked himself. No clue. Therefore impossible. Dilemma of civilized man. Body mobilized, but danger obscure.
He went to the bathroom and began lathering his face to shave. The telephone rang.
Shock, he said aloud, putting down his razor. Be prepared.
He walked rapidly from the bathroom back into the living room.
I am prepared, he said, and lifted the receiver.
Tagomi here.
His voice squeaked, and he cleared his throat. A pause, and then a faint, dry, rustling voice, almost like old leaves far off, said,
Sir, this is Shinjiro Yatabe. I have arrived in San Francisco.
Greetings from the Ranking Trade Mission, Mr. Tagomi said. How glad I am. You are in good health and relaxed?
Yes, Mr. Tagomi. When may I meet you?
Quite soon. In half an hour.
Mr. Tagomi peered at the bedroom clock, trying to read it.
A third party, Mr. Baines. I must contact him. Possibly delay, but...
Shall we say 2 hours, sir?
Mr. Yatabe said.
Yes,
Mr. Tagomi said, bowing.
At your office in the Nippon Times building.
Mr. Tagomi bowed once more. Click. Mr. Yatabe had rung off. Pleased Mr. Baines, Mr. Tagomi thought. Delight on order of cat-tossed piece of salmon, for instance, fatty nice tail. He jiggled a hook, then dialed speedily the Adhirati Hotel.
Ordeal concluded,
he said when Mr. Baines' sleepy voice came on the wire. At once the voice ceased to be sleepy.
He's here?
My office, Mr. Tagomi said. 10:20. Goodbye.
He hung up and ran back to the bathroom to finish shaving. No time for breakfast. Have Mr. Ramsey scuttle about after office arrival completed. All three of us perhaps can indulge simultaneously. In his mind, as he shaved, he planned a fine breakfast for them all. In his pajamas, Mr. Baines stood at the phone, rubbing his forehead and thinking. A shame I broke down and made contact with that agent, he thought. If I had waited only one day more. But probably no harm has been done. Yet he was supposed to return to the department store today. Suppose I don't show up. It may start a chain reaction. They'll think I've been murdered or some such thing. An attempt will be made to trace me. It doesn't matter, because he's here, at last. The waiting is over. Mr. Baines hurried to the bathroom and prepared to shave. I have no doubt that Mr. Tagomi will recognize him the moment he meets him, he decided. We can drop the Mr. Yatabe cover now. In fact, we can drop all covers, all pretenses. As soon as he had shaved, Mr. Baines hopped into the shower. As water roared around him, he sang at the top of his lungs,
Wer reitset zur Spat, durch Nacht und den Wind, es ist der Vater mit seinem Kind.
It is probably too late now for the SD to do anything, he thought, even if they find out. So perhaps I can cease worrying, at least the trivial worry, the finite, private worry about my own particular skin. But as to the rest... We can just begin.